Greg Swan here. I haven't made a movie in, I guess, a couple of months, and I don't want to say that I've missed it. For a while there, I really enjoyed it, and then all of a sudden I found out I didn't, and so I stopped making movies for a little while, and I don't promise that I will persist indefinitely, but I did want to talk about some stuff today. My name is Greg Swan. I run a weblog called selfadoration.com. I wrote a book called Man Alive, A Survival Manual for the Human Mind, and I am dreadfully interested in eradicating human error. And that is a secondary goal of mine. My primary objective, frankly, is to promote the idea of self-love, of self-adoration, ego-adoration, egoism, rational self-interest. But what I mean by rational self-interest is a reverential interest in yourself, an idea that you self-abstract when you are a child and you continue to work on iteratively all your life. The self is the most important idea in your life by far. Your relationship with yourself is your most significant relationship, again, by far. The relationships you have with other people are all a distant second to the relationship that you have with yourself. And frankly, if you guide your behavior, if you make your decisions, if you make your choices according to a standard of self-adoration, in other words, how am I going to feel about myself when I watch myself doing this, and how am I going to feel about myself in the future when these events recall themselves to my memory? And if you choose only to behave admirably, in other words, if you choose only to do those things that will result in your feeling admiration for yourself, for the way that you have chosen to act, then you will experience an enduring, ongoing, uninterruptible self-adoration, a love for yourself, a love for your life, a love for the life that you have made for yourself. And if, by contrast, you choose to behave inadmirably, if you choose to behave contemptibly, you will feel contempt for yourself now and in the future. This is obvious to any 5-year-old child that I have to go through this at this level of repetition. This level of detail is just astounding to me, that we live in a sick culture, and from the time that people are 5 years old or 6 years old or 7 years old, they are adopting hideously anti-life philosophies and attitudes. And the consequence of that is that many of us live lives of persistent, enduring misery when there's no reason for that, whatever. I mean, none, whatever. This is my commencement speech. I've been thinking about the idea of a commencement speech for maybe 3 years. I feel like I am about to graduate. I've been feeling this way for 3 months or so, that I am about to commence on my own new adventure. But I spoke just lately at the 21 convention in Austin, Texas. If you search for the 21 convention on google.com, you can find the websites for this. But Anthony Dream Johnson put this together, and he invited me to speak, and God bless him for doing this. I mean, I was a real fish out of water at this conference, and I didn't know it until I got there, and I really didn't know what to expect, and I really put my head into the lion's mouth in the sense that I am deeply committed to love, marriage, monogamy, serious commitment to the romantic relationship with your spouse. And the 21 convention got its start as a pickup artist convention, and the pickup artist influence on the convention is still very strong. I wrote at great length in chapter 10 of Man Alive about the pickup artist phenomenon, because I think it's a stellar example of habituated error, the most ridiculously outsized errors that you could make in pursuit of love and sex, and it turns into a doctrine, which is not a surprise. I mean, this is the nature of truly productive error. If you want to take advantage of other people, if you want to take control of other people, if you want to enslave other people and get them to like it, get them to be voluntary participants in your slavery scheme, then you have to sanctify some huge error. You have to document it and rigorously defend it and give your acolytes, your followers, your slaves, you have to give them talking points that they can use to respond to rational arguments when they hear them, because there's no way to sustain irrationality in the mind in the face of rational arguments without some kind of outsized, memorized propaganda, deeply disturbing lies. But anyway, I talked to the 21 convention. The participants, the audience, was overwhelmingly young men, and I thought, okay, wow, here's another commencement audience for me. And I've been talking to a lot of young people lately, some very young, I mean, as young as 3 years old, but a lot of people in their teens and early 20s, plus a lot of adults. I mean, I talk to people all the time, and I'm always talking to people, and they're always telling me their deepest, darkest secrets, the stuff they never tell anybody else, which I like, frankly, because I need to hear this stuff. I need to hear what's really going on. The show is always interesting to me. There's always this performance that people are putting on, and that's always interesting to me, but I really need to know what's going on behind the curtains to know what people are doing. So I'm delighted that they share these things with me. They might be less than delighted if they were aware of how much how much of my time I spend studying people. But it all just kind of ties into this idea of a commencement speech. And the commencement speech I always thought about making was a high school graduating class. No one will ever invite me to do this. This will never happen. But I always thought it would be fun to talk to a high school graduating class and have, you know, mom and dad, brothers and sisters, grandparents, aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews, the whole family is there to watch Junior graduate. They're all dressed up in their Sunday best. Great big social occasion. There's Junior in his cap and gown, and here's the principal and all the administrators up on the stage, and huge, very formal event. It's all Greek theater, just like religious ceremonies are all Greek theater. This stuff is all taken from the theatrical performances in Athens in particular. That's where all this stuff comes from. And that's why they're wearing caps and gowns. That's why they're dressed up like priests. Whenever you see people dressed up like priests, what you're seeing is Greek theater. But I'm imagining this huge Greek theatrical event with all of this, you know, fancy clothes and decor and elaborate program and maybe a chamber orchestra, who knows. And then I get to up to go and give my speech, and I deliver a solid 40 minutes on sexual lubricants. Because I think sexual lubricants are an essential factor in really satisfying romantic relationships. That most sex, especially sex among young people, is very bad sex. And most bad sex results from a lack of preparation. And obviously, the best preparation you could make is to prepare your mind to know what you're really doing into theory and practice. But if you're not willing to make that big a commitment, the most important relationship, interpersonal relationship in your life, is the one you make the least commitment to. That's baked in the cake. But if you're not willing to make the commitment to learn how to make love, at least sexual lubrication will make the love making better. This is a bad joke, I know, an elaborated bad joke, and this is why nobody would ever invite me to speak at their commencement address. I wrote an essay last week for freetheanimal.com called 50 Shades of Bleak, and it is about negotiation in love and sex. In love and sex relationships, in loving relationships. And the central argument of the essay, it's 2,500 words long, but the central argument of the essay is that women will get greater satisfaction out of their romantic relationships if they negotiate harder before they start having sex. This is completely non-controversial. If this is not obvious to you, if this is not painstakingly obvious to you, and you're over the age of 5, there's something wrong. There's something wrong in your head. You need to have it looked into. But in fact, I posted this essay, or Richard Nicolai, the owner of freetheanimal.com, posted this essay, and immediately there was an outsized, unbelievable, riotous, raucous, hideously emotional, angry protestations about how I can't possibly know anything and everything I have to say is crap and that I'm completely ignorant and that I ought to be run out of town on a rail and on and on and on and on. I'm a misogynist and a mangina and my ignorance knows no bounds. Which, you know, I'm freely conceited. I have no problem with that. I'm happy to say that I'm dumber than anyone, because if it matters to you to be smarter than me, if that results in some positive benefit for you, then have at it. Take it away. Carry it off. I mean, take two. They're small. It doesn't mean shit to me. It really doesn't mean shit to me, because all I know is what I know. And mainly, I'm more interested in things that I've discovered than things that I've read in some book or that somebody else said, simply because the things I've discovered, I can verify, I can validate them. But it was really interesting to me because nobody argued with the argument. The argument is, if women negotiate better before they have sex, they'll have happier relationships. That's it. I mean, that is the argument. You could go and read it and maybe you could paraphrase it differently, but as far as I'm concerned, that's a completely reasonable, accurate paraphrase. And if you swap in another argument, you see how obvious it is. When you are negotiating for a new job, if you set the terms and conditions, the hours and the pay and all of the other details in advance before you start work, you're going to have a happier relationship because there aren't going to be any surprises sprung on you later. Oh, you didn't know that you had 10 hours of free overtime a month that you had to deliver. You spell it all out in advance. You negotiate it in advance. A counter argument, analogous counter argument to this would be, you're standing outside in the parking lot of a supermarket and you want to get the best deal possible. You want to get the best food for the best price. So the very first thing you do is burn all your currency. You burn all your money. Which is what women are doing, in my opinion, in my argument, in many cases, in most cases, in their negotiations with men, that we have successfully convinced women that their bargaining power, their immense bargaining power, their power to withhold sex is not worth anything, that they do not have any right or power to withhold sex, and they don't have any right to expect anything in compensation for delivering the goods. And as soon as you start talking this way, then people get all upset too, because they don't want to think about love and sex as being some kind of trade of values. Well, every interaction you have with the universe is a trade of values, is an exchange of values, that the time of your life is your soul capital. It is a finite quantity of capital. You will die someday. You don't know when, but you will die someday. Everything that you do, every exertion that you make, every act that you take, every thought that you think requires the expenditure of energy, and that energy had to be paid for. You had to produce the wealth that you then consumed in the form of food in order to have the energy necessary to do anything. And so obviously you are engaged in trade, even if you're all alone. You're Gilligan, all alone on a desert island. I forget his name, Robinson Crusoe. You're all alone, nevertheless, and this was the point of Robinson Crusoe, frankly, is that economic man is economic man even in isolation. You are engaged in trade with the universe all the time, and in your social relationships, obviously, you're engaged in trade with other people. There are things that you want from someone else, and that someone else wants something from you, and if you can agree on the terms and conditions, then you can make a trade, and if you can't, then you have to seek elsewhere. And the same is certainly obviously true in romance. The argument that I made is that men in general, that's another one that people get worked up about, is if you say anything about anything in general, that's automatically an error. It's not an error, because we do have distributions of things, and the fat middle of the bell curve is almost everybody. And so when I say in general, I'm really saying almost everybody. But men in general are interested in romantic intimacy leading to an orgasm, whereas women in general are more interested in an orgasm that leads to romantic intimacy. And so she is not negotiating for the romantic intimacy that she wants, for the loving devotion that she ultimately wants. If she's not negotiating for that in advance, she's never going to get it. Just the same as if you don't negotiate your compensation in advance before you start on a job, you can't go to the boss 2 days later and say, I was expecting to make $25 an hour more. It's not going to happen. He's going to say, take it or leave it. And obviously, this is what men are saying to women, and women are getting screwed, and not in the good way. This is obvious to me. There's nothing about this that's not obvious. And all of the arguments skipped around that argument, skipped around that point. So we have all this caviling, quibbling, All kinds of incredibly stupid quibbling. And not one argument that said, oh no, women would be much better off if they were even less choosy about who they sleep with. Nobody said that. Which, obviously, they can't say that because it's obviously false. It's plainly false. There's, no one has any doubts about this. And even anyone who actually had the guts to say it, you know, my immediate response would be, hey, cool, can I start on your mom? And boom, then it all goes away too, because quibblers are only willing to quibble about your ox that's being gored, not theirs. But the quibbling itself was really interesting to me because it was all so amazingly beside the point. So we talked about bonobos and monkeys. The important thing to, if you really want to understand human sexuality, go study a different species. And this is a paleo food-oriented weblog, and so there are a whole lot of wannabe cavemen who participate there. And a bunch of them started riffing on these incredible arguments about what human sexuality was like 10,000 years ago or 20 or 50,000 years ago. And there are others who are deeply into paleoanthropology, I don't even know what to call it, or else DNA analysis. And so their insistence is that if you want to understand how human beings handle love and sex, then you need to look at fossil records or DNA records or whatever. All of this is complete nonsense. And this is a beautiful example of the use of the subjunctive to arrive at error. And I'm not going to insist that these folks are deliberately trying to arrive at error, although I suppose some of them are. But by this worship of the subjunctive as against the existential, we are doing something that is hideously erroneous in terms of the pursuit of truth. So bonobos monkeys, whatever is interesting about them is interesting about them alone. They do not inform our understanding of human beings. This is the dancing bear fallacy, and I talk about it all through Man Alive, and I talk about it all the time, because we do this all the time. We attempt to make this argument that the behavior of animals in some way informs our understanding of human behavior. And the reason that this is not useful is because human beings are guided by free will. We are unique in that respect. There are no other organisms who do this, who guide their behavior by free will. They do not have the mental capacity. They do not have the cultivation of the idea of the self and all of the other abstract concepts that you have in your brain at the time that you're five. One of my young friends yesterday, I saw him yesterday, and he was talking about a piece of a toy that had gone missing, and he said, I lost it. He's 3 years old, right? He correctly understood the inflected form of English verbs, and he only made a mistake because he didn't understand that lose is an irregular verb, but I lost it. He understood how to make a past tense out of losing, out of the idea of loss, out of I could lose this. Oh, wait, it's not here anymore. I lost it. Good grief, this is amazing. This is an incredible conceptual feat in a three-year-old, and he's not conceptually conscious yet. I mean, he's close. He's really close. But he's right on the cusp of being conceptually conscious, and as soon as he is, it will no longer be interesting to speak about his behavior in the context of an animal's behavior, because his behavior will be guided by free choice, by making decisions. And this is something we do not see in animals. We cannot see it in animals. It does not exist, and therefore making analogies about animal behavior is not terribly useful. It's not terribly revealing about human behavior. And in the same respect, you know, paleoanthropology or DNA analysis, I can't even think of all the different stupid subjunctive arguments that were made to try to shoot down this point about negotiation that no one actually wanted to take head on. Nobody wanted to take on the argument, but they kept bringing up all these side issues, all these quibbles, as if they were dispositive, and of course they were completely, completely useless, because every one of them presumes that the cause of human behavior is something other than free will, and in fact, human behavior is only caused by free will. The other end of the error is strictly the use of the subjunctive where the existential is available. That more than one of these people, and mainly these are men doing this, which I thought was really funny, but more than one of these people insisted, I mean, you know, with multiple exclamation points, monogamy is not natural, monogamy is not normal. These are terms that don't mean anything in the context of free will. Natural, what is natural for human beings? Nothing is natural for human beings. that nothing that is subject to the purposive choice, the intentional choice of a human being, can be called natural, because every one of those things is man-made. They're chosen. The choice is an artifact of conceptualization, an artifact of ratiocination, of cognition, of thinking. And the thinking is not natural. It is not caused by nature. It is not unavoidable in the way that the transit of the stars or the distribution of the sands on the beach is unavoidable. This is determinism. And all of academia and most of the people who are victims of academia are trapped in one way or another in this idea of determinism. And they can't escape it. They can't think outside of this stupid determinist box, even though, of course, every choice, every decision that they make, everyone that they know, everyone that they interact with, everything that they do that involves human beings is caused by nothing but free will, nothing but choice. And yet they can't talk about anything but determinism, and they can't describe anything except in determinist terms. And when they're confronted with the reality of 7 billion people, virtually all of whom are monogamous, they will say, monogamy is not natural. Monogamy is not normal. Look at the fossil record. Look at the DNA records. Look at these fascinating documents produced by communist anthropologists in the 40s and 50s. Look at all of these claims that are made by modern-day sociologists. Look at all of these, this huge pile of books that I can produce. Each one of these books insisting monogamy is not natural, monogamy is not normal, and yet 7 billion living humans, living right now, real live existential people. You can go meet them, you can look at them, you can touch them, you can talk to them, you can ask them questions, you can listen to them lying to you, and you can tell them that they're lying to you, and as soon as you do that, they will tell you the real truth. They will tell you what's really going on in your life, and there are 7 billion of them, all of them existential, none of them subjunctive, none of them existing in a universe not in evidence, all of them living in this real world right now, where you can go and interact with them, and virtually all of them are monogamous. Monogamy is not normal. No, monogamy is ubiquitous. And when something is ubiquitous, again, this is choice. This is a product of choice. Why are 7 billion people overwhelmingly monogamous? Almost none of them, I mean, maybe 1 or 200,000 out of that 7 billion are in some marital arrangement other than actual man-woman monogamy, or, you know, whatever, allow for the homosexuals who are also living in monogamous relationships in many cases, but are not man-woman relationships, but whatever. I mean, so you can subtract 1% whole, 2% whole if you want to. 98% monogamous, that's ubiquitous. And is it natural? Is it normal? What does normal mean? Normal in the context of what is the normal progression of a human life? Again, it's all a product of choice. There are no normal human beings in that respect, because that would mean human beings who are incapable of free will, who have not had the self cultivated in their mind, who have not mastered fluency in father tongue. These people don't exist. They don't exist at all. We cannot produce any specimens of this. I mean, this is 100% subjunctive, and it might be 100% imaginary. It may never have existed among Homo sapiens, but if it did, it was eradicated very quickly, because Homo sapiens don't know how to live without free will. They don't know how to live without father tongue. They cannot live without father tongue. But when you reject the ubiquitous, existentially ubiquitous in favor of the subjunctive, you are embracing error. And whether it's an intentional embrace, that you are deliberately embracing error in order to enslave other people or to rationalize your own enslavement, or you're just doing it because you have been gulled by other people, you have been fooled, this is an error. The fact that it is ubiquitous doesn't mean it's normal or it's natural. It means it works. That of the strategies that human beings have explored over the 10,000 or 50,000 years or whatever that Homo sapiens have existed, that of the marital and reproductive strategies that we have explored, this is the one that's most satisfying to people. That's why it's ubiquitous. In the same respect, I mean, Greek civilization is ubiquitous. That Greek civilization writ large, I think I've defined this as any place that you can make a telephone call from is Greek civ, a landline call. But there are 500 or so non-Greek civilizations. I mean, that's the right way to define them, is non-Greek. They're hunter-gatherer civilizations for the most part. They may be limited agricultural, things like that, but largely hunter-gatherer civilizations. They're out there. They're tribes, you know, 30 to 60 people. There might be multiple tribes. There are about 500 of them, and, you know, impute a membership of of 100 members for each one of these civilizations, plus or minus. That's an average. What are you getting, like 500,000? Is that right? No. 50,000? I can't even do the math on it, but it's a minuscule number of people compared to the people on the earth. And, you know, 500, wow, 500 cultures compared to one Greek culture. But the Greek culture, again, is way more than 98% of all of humanity is Greek. And why is this so? Because it works better, because it's better. And this is, again, this is another one that diversity, multiculturalism, the white man's burden, patriarchy, on and on and on and on. The Greek civilization propagates because it works. Because people, when they come into contact with it, like it better. And this is, frankly, this is true of those 500 civilizations. I don't know if there really are 500 civilizations left. 50 years from now, there won't be any of them left. They'll all be gone. Because the children, the traffic at the border is all one way. The children do not stick around starving and hoping that they catch something to eat tomorrow when they have the opportunity to move to the West and live a life, in their estimation, a life of ease. Man Alive is about thinking. And it's about thinking in my vocabulary. And one of the things that I did with the 21 Convention is I basically gave them a vocabulary lesson. I tried to teach them how to think in my language. And that is what's going on in Man Alive, is that I'm deliberately starting with the most basic, most fundamental stuff and building from the ground up in order to teach you my language, in order to teach you my way of thinking. And I realized, just about a week ago, I realized that so one of my own metaphors, the idea of currency, is extremely valuable actually to me. And I hadn't realized this before. I hadn't thought of it before. I speak of currency in the context of marriage. I mean, you can use it in any kind of social relationship. But I wrote about it first in the context of marriage because men are seeking one currency and offering another one in trade. And women are seeking the opposite currency and offering the opposite one in trade. In other words, a young guy who's getting married is primarily thinking that he's going to get a lot of sex. And that's the benefit of getting married, is a whole lot of sex without a lot of chicken guano behind it. And in order to make that bargain with her, he's got to promise her a whole lot of loving devotion. And so that's his promise, is a lifetime of loving devotion in exchange for a lifetime of hot sex. And her currencies are exactly the opposite, that she's interested in a lifetime of loving devotion, and in order to get it, she's going to promise a lifetime of hot sex. And in fact, what happens in marriage is that, and not every marriage is like this, so again, I'm generalizing, and if it hurts you to talk about the middle of the bell curve, then again, you're at war with the existential, because the middle of the bell curve is where the action is. This is where the truth is. But obviously, every marriage is different, and different people will have different currencies. And obviously, the whole transaction, the whole negotiation, is much more complicated than this. And one of the things that it makes it most complicated is that people don't do this in words. They'll negotiate for a job. They'll definitely negotiate to get cents off on a nice muskmelon, or to get a really juicy deal on a car down at the dealership. They will negotiate like crazy. But when it comes to making a commitment for the rest of your life and putting the lives of your hypothetical future children at peril, that you don't say anything. You just assume everything's going to work out. But anyway, I brought up this idea of currency because that's why do marriages go bad? Because one partner or both immediately starts cheating. That he's all ready to collect on that lifetime of real hot sex, but he's not prepared to deliver any of the loving devotion. And she's all over the idea, where's my loving devotion? But the hot sex, you know, turns into ratty underwear and curlers, and before you know it, a whole lot of cellulite and a whole lot of other things that make him less and less interested in delivering love and devotion to her, and her less and less interested in delivering hot sex to him, and things fall apart. The center cannot hold. But I realized that idea of currency is hugely valuable to me because I don't trade in your currency, that I make these arguments that seem to me to be unassailable. And Man Alive so far has not met with any serious opposition. No one has offered a serious argument against Man Alive. There have been, thunderstorm of quibbles, especially in chapter 2, because everybody's in love with the idea of not having to have any more responsibility for your behavior than an animal does. But so the dancing bear fallacy is always popular. But there have been quibbles about Man Alive, but there's not been one cogent, rational counter-argument. And I honestly don't think there can be. I think the book is unassailable. I think the arguments that I make are unassailable, that you can quibble all day and have at it. I don't care. And when I say that, see, that's the point. I'm trading in my currency, not yours. And so when I say I don't care, it sounds to me like I'm being, you know, arrogant and maybe even insulting, that I'm dismissing you. But I'm not. What I'm saying to you is that you're not talking in my language at all. You do not, that by raising these quibbles, all you're doing is telling me that you didn't understand what I said anyway. That you do not understand the language that I'm using. You do not understand the way that I think. And I mean, that's perfectly okay. I mean, nobody does. Again, 7 billion people on the earth, and again, existentially, nobody understands the way I think. Frankly, I think every one of you, each and every one of you, understood everything I have to say when you were 5 years old. I think there's nothing that I have to say that is not completely obvious to a normal 5-year-old human child. But I am competing with all of the vocabulary that you've learned since then, and all of that, every bit of it, is aligned against your interest, is devised to get you to betray your own interest, to enslave yourself, and to rejoice and celebrate your slavery. And this is all completely alien to me. I mean, this is really hard. I mean, it's my effort. It's my work. This is what I have been doing. I've been doing it for 33 years, is trying to figure out a way to talk to you. I have been trying to figure out a way to get through to you. And I don't know that I'm successful even yet. I mean, Man Alive was published on April 8th, so I don't know how old it is. 4 months old, 5 months old. When people do start to understand it, start to think the way that I think, the world will change. And there are already people out there who think the way I think. I know there are. There aren't very many of them. But they're out there. If you want to talk about not statistically normal and not genetically normal, but strictly ontologically normal, what would a human being, what should a human being be like if it is living appropriately? I mean, you know, we could say that if you are feeding your cat nothing but spinach, this is not ontologically normal because your cat is a carnivore. Your cat is a meat eater, and not just a meat eater, but a fresh meat eater. So the farther your cat's diet gets from fresh meat, the less ontologically normal that cat's life is. And in the same respect, my argument would be that my way of thinking is ontologically normal. I'm not saying it's necessarily perfect, because I don't believe in perfection anyway. Perfection is a pursuable goal, but it's not necessarily an attainable goal. And if you insist that you have attained perfection, I'm thinking probably you just gave up, because there's still more you could do. You could always get better. But if you want to talk about what is reasonably, rationally normal, ontologically normal for a human being, I think it's my way of thinking, my way of approaching the idea of self-adoration, the idea of pursuing your own goals relentlessly, your own goals for your own reason. I really don't care what those goals are, and I don't care terribly much what your reasons are, but I do care if you are frustrating your own goals, your own values, your own objectives in pursuit of somebody else's ideals. I care about that a lot. And I think that's what most of us do most of the time. I mean, we're not really pursuing someone else's goals. We're just basically frustrating our own. We are deliberately, intentionally, spitefully scourging our own lives. And I love that word, scourging, S-C-O-U-R-G-E, scourge, to scourge. Scourging is the participle. I love that word because it is a way of understanding spiteful conduct in a self-referential way. Every action is taken by the self upon the self, primarily, first. Whatever are the secondary consequences, whatever are the observable consequences out in the universe, the very first thing that you are doing when you take any sort of action is you are acting upon yourself. You are either building on it, burnishing it, polishing it, making it more beautiful, more lovable, more admirable, or you are defacing it. You're scratching away at it. You're chipping away at it. You are letting it go to rust. You're making it less admirable, less lovable. And most of what you're doing in your life is strictly introspective. It's in here. It's not visible out in the world. It doesn't have any secondary consequences, secondary physical consequences. But if you always choose to act upon yourself in a way that you could admire now and in the future, then you can achieve splendor. The idea that I call splendor in Man Alive, you can achieve it. This is a doable proposition. This is actually fairly easily done. It's just a matter of changing your mental habits, changing your habits, changing your behavior. And if you scourge yourself all the time, if you're always doing something that is spiteful, either to yourself or other people, it doesn't really matter. You're scourging yourself. You are defacing and damaging yourself. And the consequences of that in the long run will be squalor, will be squalor. This is not an avoidable proposition. That was another one that came up in all the discussions of sex is, well, what if she lives like a slut until she's 30 and then settles down to be a good little mommy? Well, okay, it could happen. Is it likely? Hugely unlikely that the habits that you make when you're between 15 and 25, those habits, chances are going to be with you the rest of your life. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way. Frankly, my whole approach, what I'm talking to you about, is saying to you at 25 or 35 or 45 or 55, hey, whatever it is that you're doing that's hurting you, stop. Stop doing it. You can do this. It is doable, but it's not common. It's not likely. And again, it's the invocation of a world not in evidence in order to argue with the world that is in evidence. It's the preference of the subjunctive over the existential, which, as we've illustrated, is an error. I intended to talk for 30 minutes, and I'm at 37 minutes now, so I'm likely to be at 40 before I'm done. Play it like a basketball now. I mean, I can put a basketball in my hands and throw it back and forth from hand to hand with my eyes closed. Anybody could do this. Anybody who can play basketball can do this. You dribble with your eyes closed or whatever. And I can play the guitar with my eyes closed, and it's just like a basketball for me. And I really like using my hands. Anyway, if you watch these videos, you'll see my hands all the time because I'm always gesticulating. This is a very fun way for me to talk with my hands. I like making these movies. I really do think I should do more of them, but I don't know if or when I will. I really like making them. I really like talking to you like this. I like talking straight into your eyes, and you're all alone. Who knows what hour of the day it is? It might be 3 a.m. You're watching this movie of me, and I'm looking right into your eyes and talking right at you. And I will tell you something. You can't lie to me. You cannot lie to me. No one can lie to me. But if you let yourself tell the truth, to me, this imaginary relationship you have with me through this video, or let yourself tell yourself the truth in email to some friend or just to yourself, just in the privacy of your own mind, if you let yourself tell yourself the truth, that alone will result in a huge improvement in the quality of your life. You will love your life that much more. And if you think in the terms that I've outlined for you here and the terms that I've outlined in Man Alive, if you think in terms of behaving in a self-loving and admirable way, an ennobling way, if you think about the quality of your own nobility, the nobility of your soul, of yourself, and how you can improve upon that, how you can make that better, your life will get better. My name is Greg Swan. I wrote a book called Man Alive, A Survival Manual for the Human Mind. I wrote another book called The Unfallen, which you can actually find on Amazon.com, and I would love it if you would buy it. I run a website called selfadoration.com where I talk about these kind of ideas all the time. I am very grateful to you for giving me this attention, and I know it's not easy. It's not easy having me stare at you like this and dig through your underwear drawer and tell all your deepest secrets. But never doubt my gratitude. I am very grateful to you for giving me your time and attention. I want you to have a wonderful, wonderful week. I want you to have a wonderful, wonderful life. Bless you. Thank you so much.